I was going to ask earlier a bit more context for you particularly in terms of like why this interests you, like what was the pipeline?
Yeah. So my background's in interaction design. That's what my degree was in. My final year honours project was focused on developing a project on social media literacy. This is because I have a brother who's 6 years younger than me. I use this anecdote in every interview that I do, and he hasn't figured this out yet. So, but
Nice.
now I'm starting to get more attention. I'm concerned that he's going to get angry about it. Anyway, so when I was 19 and I was in my first HCI class, he was 13 and he was starting to use social media for the first time. And I noticed that I could explain why he was having the reactions he was having because it was mostly rooted in how the interface was designed. And that's what I was learning about. But he couldn't explain that, and neither could my parents. I'm a big grudge holder. So it didn't sit right with me for the next like 2 years. And then we were asked to come up with an idea for our projects. And I thought, aha, I'll do something about this. So that's how that project started. It developed into a social media literacy program for 13 to 14 year olds, basically helping teens and the adults around them understand how persuasive design shapes their online experience. I'm working on expanding that project, but Irrational Technology is sort of an offshoot of that project because as I dove into the literature, what I realized was I couldn't really separate that from my politics. But when I was talking about this program for teenagers, I couldn't really get too political. So I started Irrational Technology as a way to expand on that analysis in a leftist manner. So in allowing us to engage in a more left-wing socialist analysis to the research I'd already done and encourage design literacy in leftist movements, because this was something I saw a lot. I came across a lot of work that suggested a lot of the impact of devices was actually to do with neoliberalism, basically. Markers of things like perfectionism have been rising since the 80s, despite the fact they're often attributed to social media. And just, the neoliberalism behind how the interfaces are designed and the ways that that intersects with the data economy and how it just basically exists as a vehicle for the data economy. So I just kind of kept reading those things, and I needed an outlet because I was driving people around me crazy. So I spent a fortune on nonfiction books, and then I started the TikTok, and it just grew. Books like systems thinking and books on the impact of social media on teenagers that wasn't like We Hate Children was also a starting point, because when I was doing my honors project, I came across that a lot. And then the ones that weren't that were often more left-wing critiques, which is also what got me thinking. Yeah, and then it just kind of delved into obsession, I guess.
I love that. I love that so much. Okay, like leaning into that obsession, the most recent thing that we were just talking about being the leftist guide to AI. Please expand on it.
People kept telling me to read The Eye of the Master, which is this book. And I'd also came across this book previous to that, which is The Myth of Artificial Intelligence. So when AI first started exploding, it was around the same time that I was doing my honors project. And I was like, I should probably learn about like the design of this. It feels kind of relevant to my career. So then that was a kind of a rabbit hole that I'd been following ever since, but I hadn't talked about it online that much. I think I came across The Paradox of Automation. I think it was maybe in The Eye of the Master or in some random Substack essay. And it got me thinking about it, basically, because the way that AI was designed and is designed and exists in the world ties in so much with societal expectations and with capitalism as a result of that. And that was what this book taught me, because computers, yeah, says it in the title, computers can't think the way we do. And currently, there's no suggestion that AGI is even possible, let alone in the near future. And most researchers agree on that. And a lot of the
AGI
way
being.
artificial gener so like the basically sentient robots. So there's no indication that that's possible, let alone imminent. I got thinking about the design, how design intersects with this, and how design basically just creates a marketing scam around AI that we do have to make it seem better than it is. Yeah, a lot of AI is just basically a marketing scam. So that's how I came across the idea of the paradox of automation, which basically indicates that the more sophisticated automation becomes, the more sophisticated an AI system becomes, the more labor is required to sustain it. But the difference is that that labor is more and more hidden. The more complex that the AI gets, the more little niche tasks there is that need to be done. So that's quite related to the climate impact as well, because obviously someone's got to run these big warehouses, but then you've got you know, you've got designers going out and going, okay, does this work the way it's supposed to? What adjustments need to be made? Feeding that back to computer scientists who make it. And then there's the content moderators, risk assessors, and all those people just expand the more complex an AI system is, but it makes the labor more abstracted. So taking the example of a self-driving taxi, instead of having one person driving a taxi, you've got a taxi that appears to be automated, but behind it, you've got like 10 people, say, that have put work into creating and are ongoing putting work into maintaining this self-driving taxi. So the self-driving automated part is a bit of a gimmick, really. Basically, what you're paying for it is luxury. You're paying to appear better than others. But the consequence of that also is you don't see the taxi driver. So you don't see, it's like complaining about how they don't get paid enough. You can't connect those things to labor because you're being told it's self-driving. So you can't connect that to the labor that goes into it, which means basically workers' rights are a playground for any idiot that wants to exploit labor.
Right. Where would you say the value does come with the automation that we have that we're able to take advantage of? And is it very much just always going to see that labor be pushed back?
I think for me, it's about regulation of the industry. I mean, obviously I'm a socialist, I'm all for boring regulations. Love boring regulations. I think they're great. But it's also about not designing something to be seamless. So this is something I've came across only very recently, so I could be not entirely getting this right. But so basically rule number one of good design is that it has to be invisible. And you can see how that plays into this issue with automation of labor, because it's invisible. Seamful design argues that the limits of a system need to be clear to the user. So you can't hide, for example, say you've got an approval system for a loan that involves an AI approval system. Currently, because of seamless design, the user might not understand why it's not getting approved. And then they can't contest that. But if you expand that to the self-driving taxi version, you can see how the idea of invisible design is exactly what makes the labor that goes into it invisible. It doesn't just make the design invisible, it makes the labor invisible. So seamful design argues that the limits of a system should be very clear and visible to the user. That can look like all sorts of different things, but studies do suggest that high talented designers who are good at what they do can pick up seamful design really quickly. So seamless design is just kind of ingrained in you from day one. But there is some studies working with designers to see how easily they can adapt to and understand this idea of seamful design, where it's important that the users are aware of the limits of a system for the sake of literacy and for the sake of advocacy. And in the case of something like the paradox of automation, so that labor is not further abstracted. It'll still be further abstracted to an extent, but this allows cooperation, allows mutual aid, allows for advocacy of workers that are involved in the creation of automated things. But you have to understand how those things are automated, which means the limits of the system need to be clear.
What does that look like in practice?
It can be very small things. So like, you should be able to see why it is that you're being recommended a post. There should be, you know, a history of, say you press a little question mark and it says, you've been recommended this because you liked this post and this post and stuff like that. And it means that if something's not working, just tell users that it's not working. In most digital systems, that is the case, but AI is a bit different. It doesn't always do that. It hallucinates. That's what AI hallucination is. It doesn't, it's taught to mimic human language over anything else. So with AI, it doesn't show those seams in the same way.
Could it be structured in such a way that it would?
Yeah, it could be. There would be a lot of design work involved in what that would look like, how you would apply seamful design to the idea of further automation and a further automated society. That would be a project in and of itself. I only read the paper on the seamful design a couple days ago, so I couldn't tell you exactly what that would look like.
But going back to the example of, say, on social media, right, it's essentially like a transparency in terms of the information that you have on yourself.
Yeah, it's about algorithmic transparency, and it's about how that should have been built in from the beginning. Like, it shouldn't be the idea that users are always lazy and don't want to do any work. It's just not true. Seamless design plays into that. It's this idea that good design is invisible. People shouldn't notice the digital systems around them. But if you don't notice the digital systems, if you don't notice how social media works, then you're not able to advocate for yourself. You're not able to understand the systems that are impacting your life. So in social media, yeah, that looks a lot like algorithmic transparency. There's arguments for like different governance models where you can, in a more user-friendly way, you can say, okay, so I've seen this post, it was recommended to me because of XYZ, don't do that, delete that data, and then it goes away. So there's things like that that can be built into systems, like algorithmic transparency.
How ambitious can we be, do you think, with certain things like social media? Because my immediate thought is, we know who owns that.
Yeah.
We know also the fact that, like, fundamentally, the way that so far algorithms have worked is, I think, quite inseparable in many ways from the things that you've been talking about in terms of actually very intentionally making it more abstract, very intentionally making your experience of social media fucking shite, yet simultaneously really addictive.
Yeah.
It feels like something that, as much as, like, if, for example, like, if we owned our social media platforms, I think an idea like that, which you're proposing, feels really powerful, feels really great, and would be likely advocated in the process of making that platform. But with the platforms that we have presently, like, what are they going to do next, almost? Because do we actually see them doing something of the sort, or actually wanting to have this kind of transparency that we're talking about?
No, of course they don't want it, but that's beside the point, to be honest. First of all, there's more of us than there is of them. Second of all, that's what my work is about. It's about educating leftists to create a movement that's able to advocate for this on a mass level. Third of all, I am a fan of the idea of platform alternatives, though they're not perfect. There's a lot of arguments about the current political moment. So the big problem with platform alternatives for a very long time has been the question of appeal. It's been a really hard problem to solve. How do you get people on platform alternatives? The current political moment, people are really sick of this, and big tech has taken its mask off, basically. It's so visible, the exploitation they're doing. So I think arguably that creates a moment where people would be more willing than they have been in the past to switch to platform alternatives, especially if they provide a more interesting experience than current social media does. But there's also quite a lot of legal cases going on. Big tech are not as sturdy as they look. There's the EU have fined Apple and they've fined Meta like $300 billion or something. And there's several cases going on in the US about monopolies and breaking down monopolies. The breaking down of monopolies allows for platform alternatives to grow. But those aren't the cases that I think are most interesting. There's two cases in Kenya at the moment. One of them is a lawsuit against Meta regarding content moderators, their PTSD and the lack of workers' rights and general poor working conditions. And the second one is about the killing of an Ethiopian professor. His son is taking Meta to court over their lack of ability, their like lack of action on it, leading to his death. And both of those cases in Kenya right now, so Meta were arguing that they were only able to be prosecuted under US jurisdiction because that's where their terms of service are located. But the Kenyan courts just ruled that that's not true and they will actually have to face consequences, which opens the door for a lot of other countries, local governments, smaller countries, individual European countries, countries other in other places in the world, to make big tech basically take account for their actions, which opens the door for, again, these platform alternatives. It opens the door for some sort of say in how these platforms are run. Big tech are not doing as good as people think they are. That's why they're arguably, probably why they're cozying up to Donald Trump so much, because they're on a slippery slope.
Need the oligarchy to support them in this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got me, I mean, immediately when you started talking about platforms, the first thing that came to mind was Airbnb.
Yeah.
I use this as an example because I think it's quite an evident example where a lot of people are like, no, I want to be on Airbnb, make a shit ton of money and like be part of the gentrification of a given city, a given environment where, you know, no one can actually live here because I've went and bought fucking half the street. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's where my mind was a few months ago. And then I was like, oh, Airbnb, love it, cute, but it's like not as many people on it. People don't really know about it. And then literally like yesterday, I was like, you know what? Fuck that. fuck that. Like, yeah. might as well invest into it. Might as well give more energy to that and give more energy to people that are willing to be on the platform, because it speaks to the people that are choosing to be on that platform, the desires. And also, I think, above all, the fact that it is a cooperative. And I think we love cooperatives in here.
Yeah.
Valuable in terms of how we start to implement and engage with people as being part of the organizations, part of the systems, part of the housing, part of the working that we do. So yeah, big on that. Anyways, that was just a tangent of mine. But more on big tech, it's not looking great for them. Why is it not looking great?
No.
For them? What else is happening there?
yeah, so on top of all the legal challenges, like I said, they're just saying they're fascists now. They're not trying to hide it, which isn't helping their case, because most people aren't fascists, especially in Europe, anywhere that's not America, basically. But the thing about that is they always have a trick up their sleeve. So any number of things could happen next. I think it's easy. For a while, I myself gave into the optimism. I was like, oh, this is great. XYZ is happening. But that's a recurring pattern in tech, especially in tech justice. You think that something's happening, you think that there's a movement away from this, and then they pull a rabbit out of the hat and everybody's using their platforms again, happy as Larry. So that's...
And what's the next thing to be on the lookout for?
So I discovered this in a Google Scholar doom scroll. It's a paper called Encouraging Serendipity in Research, Designing Technologies to Support Decision-Making. And what it does is it maps out how serendipity in digital experiences can and should be artificially created. So basically could potentially lead to a future where serendipity is being engineered by big tech. So according to this research, the key components are unexpectedness, location, memories, and a blend of familiar and unfamiliar events. And then the paper goes into great detail on how you can convince people to act on push suggestions by artificially creating serendipity. So basically this means, so for example, the example that I used in an essay I wrote about this is the Google Maps example, because that's the easiest way to picture how this would work now. So you're exploring a new city and your phone pings with a recommendation for a local restaurant. You go along and you don't think anything of it. But what you're not realizing is that behind the scenes, the restaurant pay Google to show up more in recommendations, and who Google recommend the restaurant to is based off of data that they've bought from Meta so that they can increase how successful their recommendations are. But they're doing this not under what we currently experience, which is the doom scroll, which is persuasive design, the hook cycle, screen layout, constant negative feedback keeping us on the platform. They're doing that through creating this feeling of, look what I've discovered, basically, but weaponizing that in order to get data from you, sell your data, buy your data, charge local businesses, charge any businesses of any size for appearing more in advertisement. So a lot of people in lefty tech circles, design circles, will talk a lot about interoperability as something that's important for the future. This is quite related to ideas of the Fediverse, where different platforms can talk to one another. And I think arguably this shows how that could potentially not be a solution. I remember when I first downloaded Threads just to have a little explore out of intellectual curiosity, a screen came up that said, we're going to be integrating into the Fediverse or something. And I thought, I read about that in like lefty books. What are they up to? What on earth are they up to? So I think this is probably what they're up to. Because if you integrate this idea of artificially engineered serendipity, you can still gather data without having users constantly on your platform. What it does is it allows big tech to get data from people without creating those negative experiences.
How are they able to get all that from less? Like, what is behind that?
Yeah, I mean, it's based on what you click on, what you agree to. There might be integration of wearables potentially, is something that could be possible. But yeah, it depends on basically what you click on. But if they're able to do that in a more sophisticated manner, through integrating artificial serendipity into the interface, then basically you're spending a lot less time, but you're giving them more data. And if they're weaponizing interoperability to do that and to buy and sell one another more data, yeah, you won't be spending all this time scrolling, but the data economy will keep chugging.
And how will that be for like the average experience for the average person?
So basically it alters how you experience social media. So how you experience social media right now is based on the hook cycle and habit forming products. So you feel like you're going on it out of habit, and that doesn't feel good. But if you can make the user think that they're discovering cool things naturally much more frequently than they experience right now, negative experiences of social media will decrease and you make more money. That on a technical level doesn't sound too different from people's current experiences of the internet, which is arguably the point, because this interpretation of serendipity isn't serendipitous at all. But that's the point. They can create those emotions artificially. So instead of trigger, action, reward, investment, and repeat, it'll be, oh look at this cool thing. And it'll make you feel more like you're wandering along a street discovering cool things. It creates, psychologically would create that experience as opposed to the experience of a habit forming product, which would make people question it less. It would make the doom scroll feel like less bad, I guess. But yeah, that's an ongoing project. I'm still working on like the design fiction side of that, where I'm exploring like what that would look like on a broader level. But yeah, that's the basics of it. It doesn't change the experience too materially in terms of what it looks like on a technical level, but it changes how you feel about it by changing interfaces and becoming more interoperable.
That's not great.
No, it's not great.
And how would you say, because I mean, yeah, we were also talking about this before, which is like the desire to come back to solutions and our relationship to social media, or just our relationship to tech on the whole. What does that look like? What do we do? What does it really just come down to not being on social media as much?
Yeah, I think for me, I'm not particularly interested in individual control over your social media usage. I think that that's counterproductive, and I think it's distracting us. I'm interested in people voting for left-wing candidates. I'm interested in people learning about how, when you do vote for these left-wing candidates, what can they implement? What does it look like? So this book is The Digital Republic, and that basically outlines, so politicians will tell you they have no idea how to regulate big tech. This is a pile of nonsense, because this is 400 pages detailing precisely how to regulate big tech. So I would definitely recommend that. So it talks about how you can implement citizens' assemblies for advocacy of changing how designs are done, how algorithms are done. It talks about how, on a technical level, what does that look like? What do tech professionals have to do? People like me would have to work a lot on how things are communicated so that these citizens' assemblies can work. But in doing all that involves building a broader leftist movement that's aware of these issues and can explain to people and can show people what that looks like. So yeah, socialism basically. But it involves a level of tech literacy, because you have to be able to understand how these things work in order to understand and advocate for what you want the future to look like. I think we can, on a broader level, I think the left is fully capable of creating a future where technology is regulated and in the hands of the people. We've done it before, technology, but take the NHS, for example. Like, it's not impossible.
Well, yeah, I think within the organizing sphere, you're constantly realizing things, learning things, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work, understanding practicalities, appreciating that a technique that has worked for a given community, society, whatever, in a particular location is not going to work for your location. And I think for me, one of the biggest things is being able to engage with a given topic and a given subject or person, irrespective of their perspective. I often find that the way I communicate things is way more important than anything else. And so when it comes to sharing an idea, when it comes to expressing an idea, I've often been really hesitant to say my political perspective, as left as it might be, simply because I know I'm going to get pushback from other people. So how do you talk to normal people about what this looks like?
It starts with a big, huge part of design that most designers don't do, especially in big tech, is challenging assumptions. You have to, before you start any project, go through this, write down the things you're assuming, and then assume that those things aren't true. As far as leftist organizing is concerned, that looks a lot like, you're right, you don't say that outright. For me, that would be about a process of getting people together in a room to talk about, what do you think about tech? What do you think about social media? And putting them in a place where you're allowing co-creation Just like, honestly, obviously from the perspective of having someone there who knows this inside out. But it's a kind of like a co-design practice similar to that. So I've been exploring recently how to use design fiction, which is what does a future fictionalized design look like? It's a whole design practice. It's a whole field of design. What I would be interested in and what I think would be effective in that space, I haven't had the chance to implement it because that would involve collaboration with an organization that has more resources than me. I'm just an idiot in a spare bedroom. So like sitting down with a group of people, doing a co-design session about what their problems with social media are in order to craft a design fiction about what social media could look like.
What do you mean when you say design fiction?
So it's, yeah, it's like a fictional design of a future version of, basically it's supposed to be about the near future. So it's meant to be you design some sort of artifact, some sort of interface that you imagine is what the future could look like. But in terms of allowing people to imagine a different technological future, which is really what we're talking about here, in order for people to be able to advocate for it, they have to be able to imagine it first. And you don't start by going in and going, I'm a leftist and I think this, that, and the next thing. Because that's not how you do a co-design session. It's not how designers are meant to be. It's how a lot of designers are. But it's not best practice. If you're doing design research, you're meant to go in and ask people. Don't make any assumptions. Ask them. Don't judge. And from that, I would argue that I would like to see people co-creating design fictions of what they think the future of social media should look like. And once you've got that imaginative work done, then people are more willing to take action, ask their representatives, and maybe seek out platform alternatives, build them even. But you have to do that imagination work first, which you're right, involves sort of asking people, basically. It's not rocket science. You do just ask people, but there's a particular way you do that as a designer and in a co-design environment in order to arguably create a world where people are able to imagine a different technological future.
Yeah, we recently, in the last podcast, we were talking about, because one of the people that we speak to, Chivers, is currently working on a report in running up to the BBC Charter Review, basically, about how to reform the BBC, how to reform media. Obviously, a lot of what we do concerns media, news, all of that. But a point that was raised during that conversation was this idea of the BBC, say it is mutualized, a potential of that being essentially a public social media, through the ownership of the BBC, through the mutualization of BBC, which I thought was great. I was like, that's fascinating, actually. That's a really, like, in terms of a social media that would, in the same way that we obviously have like CBBC, right, children's programming that and adolescent programming that feels quite, at least it's what I fucking grew up on, and then having a social media that said population could also engage with, that was, like you said, a lot more regulated, a lot more, and actually in like public ownership via this mutualization model. I thought that was fascinating. I just kind of want to get your thoughts on that, because
yeah,
that's just
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. Arguably, I think that should be created, as I've said, by going into communities and asking them what they want, not hiring a bunch of designers in the BBC to do what they think is right, which I don't know how good their design, their accessibility is. The BBC, that is top notch. I don't know about the state of their research capabilities or their research approach, and if it involves co-design, if it involves all these things that I've just discussed. But yeah, that would be perfect, because you've already got the infrastructure to support public ownership, which is the tricky bit. And if we do that, then probably other countries can see that it's possible. And you also have like the local Facebook group paradox maybe going on there, where people think that localizing social media is a solution, and then you go onto a local Facebook group and it's just everyone yelling at one another. So I would be cognizant of that emerging personally, because that's what I see a lot when I talk to people about social media, is people thought that localizing things was a solution, and then when you localize things, all hell breaks loose, except they're actually neighbors, and that leads to all sorts of shenanigans. So I would be aware of the Facebook group paradox. Localizing social media is not always a catch-all solution, which is why these co-design kind of sessions would be a really important part of that.
It definitely feels something that should be part of the Global Commons.
Yeah.
That was something else that was discussed today, the idea of Google being part of the Global Commons, which I cannot wait to have that discussion.
Yeah.
But is there anything I have not asked you that I should have asked you?
I think we've covered everything. In general, my approach to this is about autonomy. It's about people need to understand the systems that impact them, why they're created that way, in order to advocate for a better future. That's the point I started from. I'm getting to a point where I'm now interested in the imaginative work there as well, not just the educational work, which is about these design fictions and these this sort of like allowing people to imagine a digital future. Obviously literacy is a part of that, but there's other questions about showing people what a future could look like. That's kind of what I'm exploring right now. But yeah, we've covered all that, I think.
Amazing. So would you say, like, for you, with the next step, what does the next step look like?
Hopefully more cooperation with other people. The thing is, I probably shouldn't be advertising this in a podcast, but I didn't want to start Irrational Technology. Like, I'm 23, I have no idea what I'm doing. When I first started reading all these books about ethical technology from a leftist perspective, I thought, surely there's someone out there who's a designer who's thinking what I'm thinking, who's like not 23. Well, I was like 21 at the time when I started this, and I couldn't find anything. So I thought, right, well, I guess I'll just have to make a TikTok account. And it's frustrating, yeah, but there's other, I mean, like, there's people like yourselves and everyone that you work with who does the work in media. There's people, computer scientists, like straight software engineers, who are interested in similar ideas on a level that escapes my brain. I don't have a coding brain. So there's those people as well. And then there's people interested in tech justice more broadly. There's people working in tech justice. A lot of them do come from a journalistic background, working in tech justice in communities all over the place. So ideally a bit more collaboration, hopefully, and people being able to, yeah, getting to a point where most people in the UK can say, look, this is how social media works, this is how it impacts me, and this is what I want the future to look like. I say the UK because I'm interested in it on a local level, first of all, but obviously on a global level, this would be great. And the ongoing cases in Kenya are a great example of that on a global level.
I think the last thing I wanted to ask was if you have any, because you said you're quite alone in this insofar as no one else seems to be publicly out there talking about this. But in terms of those against big tech campaigns or tech campaigns in general, can you point us to anything? Who's doing what?
Who's doing anything? What?
Yeah.
Oh god. I mean, I just yap on the internet. But yeah. There's a lot of, I mean, I read mostly is how I understand information. So I do a lot of reading. So that's my main vehicle. And I have in my Linktree, I have a Sublime board, which has all the articles that I recommend on my TikTok. That's always a good place to start as well. There's an organization in the UK called Catalyst that are doing some work, interesting work in tech justice. There is an organization in the US called New Public who are doing work specifically on local social media networks. They're really interesting as well. Yeah, those would be my two. Those are the two main places that I would say I'd recommend people to check out.
Because, yeah, I think you're right in saying that it's not enough to just be like, well, everyone should just get off social media. Like, no, not realistic. And also not ambitious enough. But yeah, okay. Thank you so much for your time. I'm just going to stop the recording there.
Great.
And obviously advocate for people to follow you, read your Substack, engage with your social media, because it's cool. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.